Hi, my name's Sue Nelson. This is the Food Talk Show. Hi, I'm Sue Nelson, and I'm on the Food Talk Show with my co-presenter, Guy Routledge. Hello, Guy.
Hello, Sue.
You'll never guess who I've got on the phone here.
Has it got anything to do with the little boogie that you were doing while we were playing
it
the theme
actually,
tune?
It was actually, yeah. So I'm a little bit of a fan. Ali Campbell, are you there from UB40 on the end of the phone?
Yes, right here.
You are. Now, I know you're on a bit of a tour at the moment, doing wonderful songs that I love, like Red Red Wine and Rat in Me Kitchen.
Yeah.
Yes. So where are you? Where are you at the moment? Were you in Kent a couple of weeks ago?
No, last Saturday.
Last Saturday, right.
We were in Canterbury, yeah. We had 11,500 people come to see us.
My God, that's more than when you started, when you were famous.
I mean, it's the whole tour's been like that, you know. We've got, it's more like a festival than a gig. We've got the original Wailers, and we've got Raging Fire and Level 42 with us, you know. Mm. So it's a day of music.
Used to love Level 42, especially the bass. A great bass.
He's one of the best bass players in the world, in my opinion, yeah. Mark King. He's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, he's absolutely brilliant. The reason why you're on the Food Talk Show, it may sound like a ridiculous combination here, but actually, you know, one of your most famous songs is Red Red Wine. You're collaborating with our studio guest, who we're going to talk to in a minute, to produce some Red Red Wine.
Yes. We thought it was about time. We released it round about Christmas time. We had a launch in London. And, it's like 30-odd years, you know. We've been researching it.
Well, I've looked at the bottle here. It looks fabulous. So it says...
Well, it's a Bordeaux Superior, you know. I mean, some of the best red wines in the world, you know, have come from the Bordeaux area. And... We're really proud of it, actually.
So I've got the bottle in front of me. There's a lovely label. It says UB40 on the label from Ali, Astro and Mickey.
Yeah.
You've even got your name on the label. Have you ever dreamt?
I know, yeah.
Did you ever dream that you would have your name on a wine label?
Never at all, you know. The thing is that Red Red Wine was such a massive hit for us. It went to number one in England and all over the world in 1983. And then 5 years later, it went to number one in America, you know. So it had sort of two lives. And that's why it's really the song that, you know, everybody thinks of when you say UB40.
Absolutely. And I remember sort of jumping around and jiggling around to this a long, 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 long time ago. But it still seems a really fresh song to me.
Yeah, well, there's no sell-by date on good music.
I like that.
That's a great expression.
Yeah, that's a great expression.
It's funny, I was doing the research for this morning and I immediately got the song stuck in my head. And I didn't realise that it was released in the year of my birth in 1983. Wow.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's how long we've been playing it, you know.
It's incredible.
And we didn't write it, of course. It was written by Neil Diamond, but nobody was more surprised than us to find that out. We knew it as a Tony Tribe sort of rock steady record, you know, from our youth.
I actually love it. Can you just explain that, you know, the sort of thing about having some wine and getting into that? Is it really useful for promotional purposes? Are you finding it helpful?
It's not really for promotional purposes. It's because we thought, you know, why don't we have our own wine? Since, you know, our most famous hit is called Red Red Wine. You know, it's a no-brainer, really.
Yeah, it's about time.
And Eminent Live came to us, you know, and said, could we collaborate and get involved in the, you know, approving the wine and blending it and tasting it and approving it before it got bottled, you know.
You're not going to say no to that, are you? I bet there's a few tastings going on.
I mean, I was a barman back in the day before the band, you know, and we used to clean the pipes and, you know, spend all my time drinking all the different wines and that. So it's something I was used to doing. And we came up with a great wine, you know.
And you guys were instrumental in the actual development of the combinations and the flavours and stuff like that?
Yeah, yeah, we had a few tasting sessions and stuff. And, I mean, we do travel the world and have been for sort of... I've travelled all my adult life around the world, and we've stayed in some of the best hotels in the world, you know, and we do drink a lot of wine, as it happens.
I love to hear it.
So, it was fun to get involved, you know.
That's great. Okay, so if anybody wants to know about UB40 and any of the tours that they have or anything that they're doing, they just need to go to ub40.org. And yeah. I wish you a whole bunch of luck with this wine. And also, we hope the tour continues to go well, Ali, and love your music.
Well, thank you very much. Big love to everybody out there. And hopefully we'll meet someday and we can quaff a little red wine.
That sounds like a blimmin' good idea to me. Thank you so much, Ali. Bye now.
All right, cheers.
So, Jerome, meeting up with UB40. Now, I know that you've created, you know, as Eminent Wines, another. You did this, I've got in front of me, a limited edition champagne. In conjunction with The Who and Roger Daltrey.
Exactly.
Was that the first one that you did, and then, you know, you've been looking to sort of make collaborations with other sort of famous pop stars? And,
exactly.
And how on earth did you start doing this?
So my background is in wine. I've been in the wine business for over 10 years now, so initially with Eminent Wines. So I really wanted to bring an innovative approach to the wine industry by regrouping different services and products related to wine. Not focusing on quantity, but quality. Mm. I love music. I love art in general. And I always combine wine tasting in all galleries, wine tasting surrounded by sculptures of Rodin and originals of Andy Warhol on the wall. So I always wanted to combine...
Can I just ask you to say Andy Warhol again?
Andy Warhol.
Oh,
that's a beautiful pronunciation.
That is just the best thing I've ever heard. So sorry, you just distracted me there. So this combination of art and wine, but also music and wine.
Exactly. And even before that, I mean, some winemakers were artists themselves as well. And it's the Baroness Philippine de Rothschild who was the pioneer with Mouton Rothschild every year to select an artist to design the label. And it was a big, big moment every year. And she was one of my inspiration as well.
And that was really new then, wasn't it? What the Baroness Rothschild did, you know, making labels out of art. I mean, that in those days was unheard of, because every wine label looked the same, didn't it?
Really? Yeah.
Like a crest on it and, you know, very traditional. And she did something quite groundbreaking, didn't she?
Yeah. No, what she did was really, really amazing. And every year, obviously, it was the big suspense and the big moments. So I wanted to, you know, and I've been visiting Mouton Rothschild many, many times and discussed a lot with her as well, different projects. And I really wanted to take this to another level. Music is really my first love, and things came out in the most natural way. I mean, I wanted to really celebrate. We all know that champagne is obviously a festive drink. 50 years of rock and roll is worth a hell of a celebration. And we simply approached Roger and told him that we wanted to create something exquisite to celebrate his career and the 50th anniversary of his band. So that's how it sort of
But
started.
Jerome, the way you say that, you say it's like it's an incredibly easy thing. So you go, right, I ring up Roger Daltrey. Roger, do you fancy doing some champagne? I mean, that's actually quite difficult to even get past a gatekeeper. You know, how did you do that? How
if
did you manage
If you're passionate
that?
About what you do and you transmit this passion, nothing is impossible. As an entrepreneur, nothing is impossible. So if you believe in what you do, if you have the vision of it, for me, there's nothing that can come in between. So.
Nobody's going to get in your way. I can see that passion, aren't they, Jerome? I mean,
it's amazing. Yeah. So
yeah.
Did you reach out to his team through his PR, or did you just find his number on the back of a packet?
No, but we already had a relationship via Eminent Wines. We used to supply some wines as well to him, and then developed a contact, and then I simply put it out there, basically explain what I had in mind. It took a bit of time, and then in return he says, I'd love to do something, however it would be essential for me for whatever we do to bring as much awareness and raise funds for his charity as well. So he's the patron in the UK of Teenage Cancer Trust and created Teen Cancer America in the US. And then it really was a teamwork. It took, to give you an idea, 3 years to put this project together, this champagne, until the release. So from the blending to the design to all the different stages. And he was very much involved as well. I mean, taste-wise, I really wanted to create something, you know, that matches his style, that matches, you know, his DNA, basically. That was the goal. The Tommy album cover was very close to his heart, the Tommy album itself. So that was as well where we inspired ourselves for the design of the bottle.
Yeah, the bottle design is absolutely beautiful. We've got one in front of us here.
Is lovely,
and it's black and sleek with some like really like beautiful kind of turquoises and blues and greens and stuff on the bottle. It's absolutely beautiful.
We're joined by James, I'm going to pronounce your name wrong, aren't I? Arvedik, have I got it right?
Well done.
Oh, yep. Excellent, excellent. And we're going to go into your background as well with Goo and your new venture. Have you got any thoughts on this? This is an interesting collaboration, isn't it? I'm hoping we might taste some later.
Yeah, that's what I was hoping. It's like, when are you going to open it?
Yeah, do hurry. Yeah.
Well, it's funny. It reminds me of I dabbled in this area because I had a brand called Goo, which was chocolate puddings. And then I was thinking, oh, I'd like to have a nice range of wine, which I call Cru, and with an umlaut over the U as well. And I created a beautiful design, a bit like this here. And then I tried to register it. And that's where I had problems, because the appellation didn't like my registration of Cru.
especially with an umlaut on it. I should imagine they were horrified.
They're really strict about all the different classifications, aren't they? Because you've got like Cru Classé and Premier Cru and all those different kind of things. I couldn't put them in the right order, but I'm sure Jerome probably could.
Yeah, and maybe I'll talk to Jerome later about it. We can kind of resurrect this project. But it was a nice project, and the wine looked great, and this looks good too.
Sounds very interesting, yeah.
Yeah, sounds very interesting.
But they are very strict. I do agree that they are extremely strict. The Champagne region is classified by UNESCO as well, so they're very precautious on what's happening there, and they very much control.
Mm. Yeah. So you did this thing with Roger Daughtry. You've now obviously been working with UB40. I just want to correct a couple of things that Ali said, because he didn't quite get the hang of it. Do you want to explain about this wine? I know you've got, it's Merlot and Cabernet Franc.
Exactly.
Interesting to use Cabernet Franc for a change.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, again, for me, I think that these two grapes are essential for what we tried to produce and to create, matching the style, the smooth style of their music. The Merlot really brings a certain level of finesse, and the Cabernet Franc makes it very much alive. So that's what we really looked at. It's a Bordeaux Supérieur located exactly opposite Saint-Emilion Village, and Pomerol as well.
For me, Merlot, quite soft. Blackberry, smooth, yeah. And Cabernet Franc, just give it that little bit of earthiness, a bit of life.
Exactly, a bit of spiciness, a bit of longevity as well, I would say, in the mouth. And the blend is, I mean, we normally let the product really speak by itself, so we really have to open this bottle.
And how do you blend that with your very, very, very experienced wine background? And then, with all due respect, you've got a bunch of pop stars who turn up from Birmingham. How are you making sure that the blend is actually what you want, but actually will reflect UB40 as well, and sort of manage that relationship so you get the best, you know, sort of result, I suppose?
I've been doing this for now over 10 years. My goal really is to celebrate the career of legendary artists. So we have a vision, we know exactly what we're doing. And then the best part, of course, as well, is to work alongside the artists. So it's very much of a teamwork. We try to keep it as authentic as possible as well. It really has to, you know, anyone I work with has to be passionate about what's happening, and it makes all the difference. So, and these two projects were really amazing.
So it's you selling your vision and getting people to buy into it that really counts.
Yeah, and it could have been as well on the back of the mind of the artist to always do this. It really depends. Each projects are very different from each another, I must say.
Wonderful things happen when you get passionate people, and if you get two people with completely separate passions, but you find an overlap.
Yeah.
You find just that absolute magic happens in the middle.
But it's like the relationship with music and wine as well. There's a very interesting relationship there. And the effect of music on the brain, the effect of wine on the brain as well. And I'm really trying to combine these both as well. To give you an idea, a lot of winemakers play music to their vines more and more. It's more classical music, but there's a very interesting relationship there.
Really, they do that?
They do, yeah.
I've heard all sorts of different research and reports
and
stuff.
There was Prince Charles talks to plants, but
I'm sure.
You know.
I remember seeing like they put heavy metal music up against classical music to see how it impacted the growth. And when I think it was some Discovery Channel show or something like that. And I was thinking, this is a load of nonsense. But they tried to do it as scientifically as possible. They had the control group, they had the heavy music, the classical music, and they measured the difference. And funnily enough, heavy metal came out on top.
That's what you need to do, Jerome. Ditch the Mozart and go for a bit of Prodigy or whatever.
I always talk to my coconuts and they taste a lot better after that.
Never thought I'd hear that in a sentence.
How much wine is required first?
I always talk to my coconuts. We'll go on to your coconuts in a minute, obviously. But Jerome, Eminent Wines, you started this 4 or 5 years ago as a company?
Approximately 8 years ago, yeah.
Oh, 8 years ago. Yeah. Okay, and the main thing is you're a wine company, you're an importer, or do you actually produce your own wines?
Well, we import, distribute around the world, and now we create our own products by combining arts with wine. So we really like these two products we've got here, like the champagne we did to celebrate 50 years of The Who and the red wine for UB40.
So who are the customers for this then? How do you sell this? Is it just online or?
Wine passionate, wine collectors from around the world. Yes, we do sell, and fans obviously, of course, of
and the
artists and the bands. We sell this online on eminentlife.com, and then we have different point of sales across the UK, different distributors around the world. So yeah.
And do you target very specific types of artists, or are people starting to come to you and say
legends?
Legends! They have legends. To be legends.
Legendary artists. And yes, I mean, we're already working on different projects that we'll be releasing, some later on this year, some next year. I mean, it does take time. It's not a quick, a quick setup. And it's I want to do this right, basically. You know, attention to detail and really take the time to do it properly. It has to be as authentic as possible and match.
With those partnerships that are already in progress that you're saying maybe later this year, maybe next year, is that something that you kind of keep hush-hush until the big launch?
Totally.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, interesting. Because I guess there's two different schools of thought. Some people say you either keep everything...
Trail it.
yeah. You either, keep it behind the curtain until it's ready and you do a big reveal. Or you say, we've got this amazing thing that's coming up and you just build and build and build buzz until that event, and you can, different ways of doing the same thing, of course. But
and we had two different approaches for the champagne and the red wine. We, for example, did a blind tasting at the Isle of Wight Music Festival for the champagne. We didn't reveal the final design. Mm. It was just to give a hint. Mm-hmm. And then progressively, we got it out there. And for the red, it was just, a live performance to launch the wine. So, yeah. So it depends per project, shall we say.
Sure, that makes sense, yeah.
So if we can talk a little bit about your background, you didn't sort of go and study wine to start with. You're a psychology student, and I always worry about that because I always think you're sitting here analysing me. But so that was your background. How did you sort of get led into it? You were a sort of pastry chef for a little while, weren't you?
Yeah, I did an internship in Paris in the, pastry. And so I was still studying psychology in London, and always loved wine, always been passionate about wine. So that wine was obviously not too much part of the culture in the UK, like it is in France or Switzerland, where I'm from. And but the passion was then increasing. It really was increasing. People wanted to know, why do you let a wine breathe? Why this, why that? They really wanted to look at it from a closer point of view. And I used to go quite a lot on holidays at a vineyard in Provence next to Saint-Tropez. And I realized that the wines were not on the UK market. So that's how I started, by representing one vineyard, presenting the wines in different shows in the UK, different sommeliers. And it really started in the most natural way from there. So again, passion mainly. So,
and James, you've got a background in the food industry as well before you became an entrepreneur. Do you think it's really important? We have a lot of food businesses listen to this program. Do you think it's important to have at least a little bit exposure to the food and drink industry before you launch into your own thing? It's a difficult industry, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, I think call me old fashioned, but I think it does. I'm sure it's true of every profession. It does help to have worked in the business, hopefully for a good company. So you know all the pitfalls, you know the things that you've got to look out for. And I spent, I would say about 10 years in the food industry before I branched out on my own. Maybe too long, actually, but it certainly didn't do me any harm.
And in terms of sales and marketing, which I know is a bit of your background, this is a really good bit of sales and marketing, isn't it? You've got to get your packaging right. I mean, Goo is famous for its packaging, I think. And you were a little bit groundbreaking in terms of what your puds look like.
Yeah.
And again, here, they look impressive.
Yeah, it looks
they?
Great. Yeah. Mm. I mean, I think with trying to make things as simple as possible, I think you make a promise and then you keep a promise. So the packaging actually makes that promise in the first place. That's what draws you in. And then the quality of the product keeps it. And that's the basis of loyalty. That's why people come back again and again. So I think if you've got them both absolutely bang on, then that's what works.
I really love that kind of expression, you know, it's about making a promise. And I guess you could even say that the whole brand is an extension of that promise. You know, everything that you do, the way it looks, the way it speaks, the way it feels. It's fantastic.
This does look limited edition, what you've done here, Jerome. And I guess for what you're doing, it has to look like a limited edition, doesn't it? It has to look like something you want to keep or is very, very, very special, because that's the end of the market that you're in.
Exactly. And it's very funny the different type of clientele we deal with. Some people won't even open it. They'll keep it like a piece of art, like collecting piece.
When we say limited edition, how few are we talking about?
We don't. I mean, for the wine, we can produce around 10,000 bottles per year. And so
it is still limited, but we're not talking like there's 10 in the world and we're about to crack one open.
But we don't want to disappoint the fan
you've got to get that just right, haven't
you?
Well, we're going to take a little break because we've got a little pre-record. I'm hoping, if we can persuade Jerome, but there are three of us against him, that he might let us crack open these and we'll have a little taste on air after we've done our pre-record. Speak to you in a minute.
So, Sue, we've just held the first Food Talk Awards. Can you tell us all about it? Where did it happen? Why did it happen? And was it good?
Well, it was at Oxo Tower. We had about 125 people, all from the industry. It was fantastic. We had great food. Everybody was chatting. Everybody was doing business together, which is not what we expected. And it was fabulous. It was brilliant.
And what sort of people did you want to enter these awards and why?
We were after people who were doing things that are quite different. So somebody who's really grappling with a difficult problem, and that could be trying to take allergens out of a foodstuff or trying to find a new way of processing something or packaging something, or even, you know, new ways of trying to save food waste. So there's a whole range. So we weren't just focusing on taste, because that's a given. We were really looking at people who are pushing the boundaries and really trying to do something different.
And why should we as the consumer care about what these people are up to?
Well, it's food. It's the most important thing in the world. If you don't have it, you will die, literally. So food is very, very important. And I think that a lot of people are quite shocked and upset about the horse meat scandal. I think that was a turning point in a lot of people's minds. So that they really thought that if they went into a supermarket, that somehow these people were the guardians of what they would eat, and they would know where everything comes from, and they would track it for them and ensure the quality. And I think there's a real shake up when people realise that actually they didn't even know where this stuff come from, let alone what animal, let alone what country. And it is important. And I think for me, when you've got children in particular, it really focuses the mind, because you want to look at what are people eating? You know, it's got to be clean. I don't want loads of rubbish and chemicals and stuff. And I want to make, you know, eating as pure as we can.
And did you discover anybody during the entries process who was news to you in terms of what they've been doing?
Lots of them had already been on the show, which is good. So we had the great pleasure of talking to them already. But yeah, there were some really interesting ones. I mean, some of the stuff I've sort of stolen because it was so good. I've sort of stolen some of the stuff and taken it home because it's a real revelation to me. So, for example, British Biscotti make great biscotti in Britain. Well, I didn't know that. And I've just come back from Italy. And I have to say theirs is just as good, if not better. So, I mean, have you had biscotti?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, I've enjoyed their various flavours.
So there was that, and then we had the sort of People's Choice winner on the night, because the whole of the audience voted, was Boozy Udders, and they make very boozy ice cream. And again, that was a bit of a revelation, really. It's a really grown up pudding. It's got really great ingredients in it, but it's great fun. So those are the sorts of things that I was quite inspired by.
And was it a fun atmosphere on the night?
Yeah, so we set it up so that when you came in, there was literally a market of people who'd been shortlisted. So from chocolates to, British biscotti to ice cream to, what else do we have there? We had fruit juice. We had all sorts of stuff. Drinking fudge even. And people could go and taste these things and then go and vote for the things that they thought were the best on the evening. So we shortlisted them from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of products. And I think what was great and why the evening was so good is because people were invested in finding out who the winner was, because they'd voted and they'd tasted. I've been to loads of these awards and actually have to say some of them are quite boring. And I thought this was great because actually you could get involved and everybody was cheering like hell when somebody won because it was something that they'd tasted and been part of.
Okay, so having had a fantastic first event, what are your ambitions for next year?
Well, obviously, it's got to be bigger and better. And we're hoping that the first awards will be publicised far and wide. And indeed, they have. Social media has gone crazy over what we've done. And I think what that will allow us to do is spread the net much, much wider and get, you know, huge more number of people to submit what they're doing, tell us about what they're doing, tell us their story and what they're trying to crack and what they're trying to, you know, how they're trying to make the food business better. So I'd encourage anybody out there, it's all free to apply. We don't make it difficult. You don't have to write essays. I've entered some of these awards and taken days and days over them. We don't want it like that. So it's free to enter. And we just want to see far more innovation out there because I know there's loads going on. That was all very interesting, wasn't it? That's good stuff. Now, we can't wait. We've got our bottle of UB40 opened. James is here and I can see he's...
salivating.
He's pretty, jumping at the bit.
He's pretty chuffed to be invited to a food programme. Didn't realise he was going to be drinking wine in the afternoon. So that's James...
That's the way to do it.
Yeah, James Arbadik of the Coconut Collective. And we're collaborative. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But let's taste some wine. So, Jerome, I don't know, do you want to pour in case I get it wrong? And you, as a Frenchman, you'll look down your nose at me because I don't know what I'm doing.
Swiss.
Oh, you're Swiss. I beg your pardon. Well, that's okay, then I'll let you off. So you're pouring this. And as we said, it's Cabernet Franc and Merlot. He's just smelling it now just to make sure it hasn't caught. And it hasn't.
Yeah, smells like
that's
wine.
Good. And actually, it's boiling hot in the studio, so I'm sure it's going to be roughly at the right temperature.
I'm interested. How many bottles, because everybody talks about wine being corked, what percentage of wine is corked? Does anybody know?
As in gone bad, rather than got a cork in it.
Tiny amount, I would think.
About 1%?
I don't think I've ever had a corked bottle, and I do drink a little bit of wine.
You've got a computer.
Oh, let's see if I can. Yeah. I've only got a little bit of battery left.
Obviously, more and more screw tops, though.
Yeah.
So presumably it's not an issue.
And even the material that they use for the cork, some of them do guarantee nowadays that it is not possible for the wine to be corked. But it all depends what type of wine it is, if it's something you need to keep or something you're going to drink young as well.
So according to my Google machine here, approximately 2-3% of bottled wines can suffer from wine cork taint, known as TCA in the industry.
And it's a bacteria that develops. And just to confirm that, you know, when a wine is corked, it can happen to any wine. It's got nothing to do with the quality of the actual wine. It's a fungus that develops. It can happen to any wine.
Can it happen even in a screw top wine? Or is it just because of a reaction with the cork?
Logically, it could not happen in a screw top wine, but yeah.
That
it smells quite strong.
Actually. You can hear is James deliberating. Your thoughts? This is radio, so.
Yes. Yeah, it's good.
I'm getting slight, very very fruity. I would say
jammy fruit.
Very
definitely.
Very very jammy.
Yeah.
And the aftertaste, I would say, is that earthiness coming through. Then you get that little bit of pick up afterwards.
Yeah. And now you'll see the difference as well. I mean, we just opened the bottle now, and you will see how it will evolve in your glass as well.
Needs a bit of aeration.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It feels quite boozy. It's at 13%. Yeah. Which I guess that
feels
makes sense.
Quite boozy. That's a technical term.
Yeah.
Isn't
well, I'm a technical wine drinker. Not an expert.
And I fairly recommend that. Actually.
I have to say, I'm generally not a huge fan of French wine. I tend to be a bit more new worldy because my partner's from Australia. We drink a lot of Australian and South African, so it tends to be a bit more gutsy, whereas the European stuff tends to be a bit lighter. But on an afternoon like this, where it's absolutely roasting hot, it's actually really refreshing and you know, much lighter. You wouldn't want to, you know.
Very jammy, though, if you like that sort of Merlot, but with a little, it's not quite as soft as a Merlot. It's a bit nicer, actually. It's got that little pep up at the end.
Yeah.
Very good.
And it's nice to drink now, but it could as well evolve in the next 10, 15 years, so you can celebrate it up as well.
Just to let you know there, Jerome, there is no wine in my house that has ever lasted 15 years.
15 minutes?
Ever. No, not 15 minutes. I can keep stuff for longer than that, but I know you should keep some stuff, but I just can't. No, it's for drinking. While we're slurping on that, James, can we talk to you about your new venture? Again, we're going to have a little bit of a tasting thing going on. So we've got some lovely red wine, and you've bought a little cool box, and it says Coconut Collaborative. You're very, very experienced in the food world, so we'll talk about goo later. What is this new product about? What's it all about?
So the Coconut Collaborative is a range of yogurts and desserts that are made with coconut milk. They're totally non-dairy. And surprisingly tasty. The whole world of dairy-free is changing quite rapidly at the moment, because a lot of people are, even if they're not lactose intolerant, are making a positive choice to reduce the amount of dairy. I mean, for instance, I love creamy products. I love cheese. But even people like me are going what is termed as flexitarians. So we are becoming more flexitarian. So we might say, well, you know what, on Monday and Tuesday, I'm not going to have any dairy. Anyway, so I started looking at the whole non-dairy market when I sold my last business. And I love coconut milk. It's the creamiest of the non-dairy milks. And you can get a really good, almost like a dairy taste, actually. So I started playing around making yogurts and desserts, and et voila.
We're letting you talk because we're just scoffing. We're just scoffing away.
But I'm going to join you.
Yes. Jerome's tucked into the chocolatey one.
No, that's the lemon one he's got.
I've got both.
No, he's eaten the chocolate one already.
This chocolate is so smooth. Sorry to interrupt you, Sue.
Is it? I haven't tasted that one yet.
That's really good.
Jerome, just by coincidence, are you lactose intolerant?
I am.
You're saying so. What? You're an expert, really. So what do you? What are you thinking of the chocolate one?
I know the taste is amazing. It's very, very good, very good.
Not good, but very, very good.
It doesn't taste overly coconutty, because for a while I was dairy free, and at the moment I've cut milk out of my diet. But a lot of the products tended to be. Just they had that overwhelming coconuttiness, which maybe for some is exactly what they're after. But this is amazing.
It's interesting because it's coconut as an ingredient, not as a flavour, and that's different. I mean, I think a lot of people associate kind of bounty bar or coconut with bounty bars, or
and that texture as well. But some people are a little bit frightened of that texture.
That's true. And actually, coconut, I'm not. You know, it's not necessarily a negative thing. It is quite polarizing. So some people love it and some people hate it.
Yep.
And but I think with my stuff, people are surprised that it tastes as creamy kind of, if you like, quite rich.
And what about this lactose thing? You know, so many people are lactose intolerant and avoiding it for those reasons. But as you say, some people are being much more flexible about the diet and saying, I'm going to have milk for this amount, you know, during the day, you know, these weeks or whatever. Do you think that there is a real health issue about this? Or is it just fashionable at the moment that people are saying, well, I've heard lactose probably might not be very good for you, so I'll avoid it?
I think the stats are that with Caucasians, 4 or 5% of Caucasians are lactose intolerant, and the further east you go, the higher the level of lactose intolerance. So maybe this is a product for China at some stage.
Well, the number
India
that I've got,
and China.
The number I've got here is 13 million people in the UK are lactose intolerant. And nowadays, 1 in 4 Brits are eating free from. Whether that is, because they can't or because they're choosing to, is not, 100% known. But,
Well, us marketing folks, we always have labels for these people, and there are a lot of lifestylers. So, going back to your point, coconut is quite trendy at the moment. It's kind of riding this health wave of. I suppose it's the kind of, it started with the gluten-free and then it went into kind of nut milks, and then there was coconut water and, coconut yogurt. And, there is a health benefit because dairy can be quite bloating. It can be quite bad for your skin, even if you're not actually intolerant. And also, there is an eco argument as well, because, you know, my milk grows on trees, as it were, is incredibly good for the environment. Cows, whether you love them or hate them, are actually quite bad for the environment.
Absolutely.
You know, they emit a lot of noxious substances.
And it's not sustainable to keep farming animals. I mean, we're hearing that more and more on this programme. You know, lots of meat replacements, and people saying we can't keep using animals for food.
Well, the amount of
whether that's an ethical consideration or not, it's a practical consideration. Is just not enough, you know, not enough animals.
There's not enough
and
space
not enough
to even grow the food to feed the animals, which you then feed to the people. So, I mean, the whole thing is, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love a good steak, but it's trying to find that balance. Just like you were saying with flexitarianism, which is probably wasn't even a well-known term a couple of years ago, but is now starting to appear in the media and be, you know, this known thing of just being more flexible with your diet and choosing to include or to exclude certain things.
I've just tasted the yogurt. Jerome, you need to taste that. It's very good indeed. What you need to do is dig your spoon right down the bottom, because we've got yogurt on the top and then there's a lovely layer of strawberry, I think that is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Strawberry.
Yeah.
It's a huge pot. Is that for use during the week, not in one sitting?
Yeah. I mean, us Brits, we like to buy these big pots of yogurt and then, you know, just gradually munch our way through them. So... Yeah. I'm just, I launched small pots, and then as the brand got bigger, I went to these bigger formats. You can offer a better deal on them as well.
Oh, I've just tasted your Coconut Vanilla Collaborative Madagascan Vanilla.
That's good, isn't it?
Really,
it's amazing.
Deep taste and amazing texture. When you consider it's free from dairy, that's incredibly difficult to make, isn't it? And it's vegan, of course.
So here's the thing. It's just like there is no... what I was trying at the start, and Jerome was talking about passion, and my passion is also great taste. And because I did goo, you know, I was never going to launch anything that didn't taste good.
Absolutely.
But I wanted to turn this kind of free-from area into something that you could really enjoy from a food point of view. So, and a lot of free-from food is quite bland and... tasteless,
it really is,
and that's what I wanted to achieve with this business.
And how difficult was the texture to achieve when you've got non-dairy? Because that yogurt is really creamy.
It's got exactly the same consistency.
How difficult was that?
Well, I mean, of course, I would say it's difficult. You know, but then everybody says that their job is difficult. It is quite difficult making yogurt from coconut milk. It's a very sensitive material. It's not as homogeneous as milk is. So you tend to get variation depending on the soil conditions, the harvest, etc., etc. So it is a bit of a kind of alchemy, I would say, you know, producing a consistent product out of a tricky raw material, which is coconuts.
It made in the similar way to a milk-based natural live yogurt with the live culture and the lactic acid that gets either built up or consumed by the bacteria? I forget which way it works. Funnily enough, I was listening to a podcast all about yogurt this morning, but it kind of went in one ear and out the other. But is this process very similar?
Yes, it is. So we basically add the live cultures to the coconut milk, and it basically ferments and the pH drops, and then it becomes yogurt 5 hours later. And actually, it's in that way, it's quite similar to how dairy yogurt is made. We have to add, because there's not... one of the reasons why people really go for this is it's very low in natural sugars. So coconut milk is incredibly... If you compare the nutritional of my products to a standard dairy yogurt, the fat level is actually quite high, but it's good fat, and the sugar level is incredibly low. So if you add cultures to it, we actually have to add some rice starch to it to help feed the cultures, and that then brings the pH down to yogurt. In yogurt itself, the cultures feed off the lactose, And that's what makes the yogurt. But the process is very similar. Yeah.
Now, we had Craig Sams from Green and Blacks on here a few months ago. And obviously, he's an amazing food hero, really, in that he, I suppose, a bit of a hippie, really, probably, but predated quite a lot of the health things that were coming out. He was convinced that the next big thing in food is all about your stomach and looking after your stomach, and you know that you know sort of bio, whatever they're called,
the microbiomes,
and that's very much what this is about. Actually, is playing to that market. A lot of people are realizing that stomach health is really important.
Gut health, yeah.
Yeah, gut health.
But it almost seems like that is a, the way that this is all positioned. You know, it's positioned as a very luxury item. It tastes fantastic, and it's like all of that stuff is an added bonus. Whereas a lot of this, you see that some of the products that are marketed and they're kind of pushing this health stuff. Yeah. When you dig a bit deeper, there's not actually that much health benefit to it. So this seems like a wonderful match made in heaven.
Well, I wanted first and foremost to make it taste good, but also I want it to be a natural product. And I think I've achieved that. And it is quite courting danger to start going on about health benefits and then slagging off dairy and everything else. And to be honest, I wouldn't do that. I'm lucky in that this kind of whole non-dairy market is just taking off, and coconut has got a very positive image. And therefore, I'm not making very hard-hitting health claims, because it's quite tricky and you never know where you're going to end up. But I do know my stuff is very natural and I know it tastes good.
I think you got that right. And it tastes particularly nice with a glass of red wine,
yeah,
may I
exactly,
say.
I think Jerome's finished the whole bottle, isn't he?
He has. That's Jerome's finished the whole bottle and all the coconut. So I'm just highlighting the packaging now. We're just saying about Jerome's products and you know, how important to portray the fact these are limited editions and to do with music and, you know, heritage. I said that earlier your packaging's a little bit racy. Well, it's probably not racy. But it's, again, it's absolutely bang on in terms of the brand, isn't it? Because it looks natural. There's a slight bit of humour there, a tiny bit of wit. It's not dry, is it? And it definitely portrays, I think, the sort of brand image. Now, somebody who's been highly successful with Goo and sold that for an awful lot of money, how much is packaging important to you, and really concentrating on that?
I think it is obviously important. Branding is, you know, to catch people's eyes is very important. And, you know, I've always invested quite a lot of money in the branding and the look and the feel. And that's worked well for us. It's a very different, my new brand, the Coconut Collaborative, with the two kind of naked cartoon characters,
that's
Adam
why I said
and Eve.
It's slightly racy, yeah. Adam and Eve.
It's very tasteful, though, in an illustrative kind of way.
Yeah, but drawn in sort of pen and a little bit quirky.
Exactly.
And quite innocent in a way.
It kind of reflects the, you know, that, as I say, the natural part of the product. So I think people like things that look a little bit different, that kind of stand out from the crowd, and that's what you need to do. And I've always, in fact, I used the same agency for the Coconut Collaborative as I did for Goo, and they're two very different brands.
Yeah, completely.
I
mean,
incredibly different, actually. They couldn't be more polar different, could they?
I know.
Well, that's good, though, because what you're doing is really thinking about the context of where these products are going to be seen.
Yes, and also the consumer. So what is my kind of bullseye target consumer into, and they're really into kind of natural products, number one. So it needs to look very natural, quite earthy, and so on. Goo was a much slicker brand.
It was almost a little bit food porny, if I may say.
Yes, it was. I mean, if you
and
remember,
it was even more risque.
And photography.
You'll probably remember that M&S chocolate pudding ad. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
which
right,
was the birth of food porn, wasn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely.
It was,
yeah.
Really, yeah.
I did a similar ad, and it had a similar effect. You know, it's kind of, in some ways, it was
works,
very easy. But you know, timing is everything in the food business. And actually, Goo, because it's loaded with kind of fat and loaded with sugar. Yep. And
it's a treat.
It's a real treat. Mm. But it's something that, and actually it's still doing very well. And I still buy it occasionally. In fact, when I sold the business, I did negotiate that I had a lifetime supply of goo.
That's brilliant.
As part of the deal.
Okay, Jerome, so take note of this. If you sell your business, part of it has to be I have a lifetime supply of wine. Thank you very much.
We own some of the vines, so it's okay. We've got it on the
contract. Okay, you've got it.
Fantastic.
That's good. That's good.
Very smart.
Of course, I very rarely take up my my lifetime allocation, but anyway, I think the in the last few years, people have become much more concerned about healthy products, and I mean, it's kind of funny how health has become a big part of people's identity. So you know, people now dress to go to the school drop-off, you know, they dress up in yoga gear and then they go and do their class, and then they'll have a coconut yogurt for breakfast. You know, it's that type of thing. Whilst goo is almost probably seen as, oh, that's a little bit too indulgent now, or maybe very much just a treat. So again, you know, I think if I'd tried to launch coconut yogurt 15 years ago when I launched Goo, I'm not sure it would have worked.
It is about
it's a timing thing. Yeah,
timing is very important. Mm. Yeah.
So can we talk about you as an entrepreneur? We see loads and loads of different people on the program with all sorts of different companies. And
absolutely,
and, you
know, yeah. From all different levels.
All different levels and all sorts of backgrounds as well. Mm-hmm. Did you actually start Goo yourself, you know, with your own money? Or I know the exit, but how did you enter?
So it had a, like a lot of these businesses, it had a fairly chaotic, completely illogical start. I was selling margarine in Belgium.
Oh dear.
I was living in
Brussels.
Can't
get worse than that, can you? In Belgium.
Well, you know, Belgium was the birthplace of margarine. I was up against Unilever and I was having a torrid time. I was trying to sell a brand called Utterly Bustly.
And I think I remember that one.
Do you remember that brand?
That brand, yeah.
And anyway, I didn't get very far. But in the process, I suddenly started thinking, oh, life's got to be better than this. There's got to be a better use of my talents, whatever those talents are.
Margarine in Belgium.
Yes. And I was in a patisserie next to my office, and I just started. They had this kind of chocolate bomb, and I just thought, oh, actually, this looks much more interesting. You know, I could sell these. And the whole kind of visual side of it was what kind of got me into it. And then I thought, well, if I could find a way of wrapping a brand around very artisanal Belgian patisserie, that would be a good business. I mean, that was the original idea. And then, you know, I did absolutely nothing with it. I just thought about it. And I'm sure a lot of people are the same. They
just
have
keep
an idea.
Paying the mortgage, carry on.
Exactly.
And head down.
They occasionally, you know, when they have a couple of these to drink, they come up with some crazy schemes. But most people do absolutely nothing. And about a year later, I was still flogging margarine. I was flogging a bit of yogurt at that stage. And then this guy asked me what I did, and I just couldn't.
Were you embarrassed to tell him?
I used to be embarrassed about saying I was a margarine salesman. So I said, you know what, Tony? I run a chocolate puddings business. I completely made it up.
And then you all of a sudden get invited to lots of dinner parties after that, I bet.
Well, yeah, that came. But anyway, the next day I suddenly thought, I can't keep on just fantasizing about this business. I've got to actually do it. So you know, I think the first quality, if you like, or the first thing that an entrepreneur does is take some action. You don't just talk, you actually do something.
Absolutely.
And so I decided that that was day one. And then I found a partner, because I couldn't do it myself. He had a factory in North London, and he had industrial patisserie. So it was the perfect place to develop these products. And we then did the business together. So it was actually two of us. I was he made the products and I
sold them.
Basically sold them.
Mm. Yeah. Fantastic.
And as we say on this program quite a lot, sales. The product can be amazing, but you have got to go out and sell it. It doesn't matter how brilliant it is, you've got to keep
even if
concentrating
it's delicious
on
chocolate,
the sales.
It doesn't sell itself.
It's interesting because I think with food, I mean, the difference between good products and bad products often isn't that much. Mm. So I think generally you've got to be about 5% better than everybody else. And I think if you're 5% better than everybody else, you will
survive.
You will survive and thrive.
And when you say better, do you mean better taste, better product, or better brand?
Better everything.
I think, yes, I mean, obviously it's a completely kind of subjective measure, but I think generally, you know, you have just got to be a bit better than everybody else and maybe anticipating what's coming. And, you know, you've got to have a look that I always talk about the touch and feel of brands. So I think, you know, going back to something we were talking about earlier, the authenticity of a brand. Mm. So it isn't just kind of a marketing idea. It's got some real substance behind it. And I think people like to feel that there's a person behind it, there's a story behind it, and there's a great product behind it. Yeah. And then
it's a complete package then, isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then you've obviously got to be very passionate and you've got to sell it. Mm-hmm. And I always enjoyed doing it.
And so you started off this company, Goo, very interesting name with umlaut. Again, is that for standout reasons for you? Really different from anything else that was out there?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because when I we developed this chocolate souffle, which was our hero product, and it was really, you know, an outstanding product. I still love it. You basically stick it in the oven, the top of it kind of rises, and then you kind of dive your spoon through this chocolate crust into this chocolate lava, and it's beautiful. It is beautiful. And then, but we didn't have a brand, and I took it to this guy who. I subsequently worked with a guy called Perry, and he developed. Suddenly, 2 weeks later, he said, James, come to my office. He said, I've got something to show you. And he showed me this branding, and he said, I discovered this. It was a beautiful illustration. He said, it looked like a photo. And he said, I've discovered this in Scandinavia, in Sweden, and they're doing exactly what you wanted to do, and it's almost uncanny. And I looked at this and thought, oh, my God, someone's beaten me to it. You know, this is a beautiful brand. And he then kind of started smiling. He said, no, it doesn't exist at all. It's all yours. That was the way he sold it
to me.
What
a wag he is. Hmm.
Anyway, I then umdenard. I liked it, but I thought, I don't know. And I went back, and it was the days that I remember I did a Google search for Goo, and it came up with genital urology as the as you know, in my Google thing. I thought, oh, I can't launch that. And I remember talking to Perry. I said, you know, do we really want to go with this kind of brand? And he said, yeah, no one's going to worry about that, James. Just forget about it. Just get on and do it. Mm. So I trusted him. And yeah, it did grow into a great business.
And the scale up thing, how difficult is that? I mean, again, we see a lot of people who get to the sort of, they get to kitchen table, then they'll find a production house, somebody to produce it. But it is that moving from, I would say...
Well, once you get into a couple of supermarkets...
200,000, 300,000 turnover, maybe getting into Waitrose, for example, and then that next leap. How difficult is that step up?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure everybody says it's difficult because it is difficult. But I think most people with a good product and who are reasonably smart do work it out. Mm. They work, you know, one thing about entrepreneurs is that good entrepreneurs are great survivors, aren't they?
And they're problem solvers.
They're problem solvers, and they're permanently reinventing, you know, what they've got to do next. So most of us are fairly self-taught. You know, we kind of learn on the job and adapt quickly. I mean, the one good thing about having your own business is that you don't have to report back to tons of other people. So I always find working for a big company, I had to spend half my time doing reports.
You never get anything done, yeah.
Never get anything done. The great thing about having a small business, probably the only good thing about having a small business, is that you can actually do everything yourself.
And change direction very quickly. And if something doesn't work, you can just drop
it. Adapt quickly.
And,
yeah, so, yes, it is difficult, but I haven't met anybody who says their job isn't difficult.
If someone said it was easy, you would just laugh at them and walk away, probably, because it just, there's no way that it can be. There's so many different things to do. And there was one thing that I was interested in asking you, because of the, you have had these two different experiences, one where you kind of created the thing from scratch, you know, didn't even have a name, didn't have any kind of branding.
Yeah.
And then the other with the Coconut Collaborative, I believe that it was an existing company that you bought into. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, well, it was an ice cream company with a different brand name.
Mm, yeah.
So, and I met these guys and I liked their product, their ice cream. I dabbled in ice cream before with goo, and ice cream is incredibly difficult because you're up against Häagen-Dazs. Mm. And
the goo ice cream was
big,
good though.
Big brands.
It was good, but it wasn't good enough to survive because there was already very good ice cream around. So I was quite, anyway, I just thought, this would be a good way of, this would be a shortcut to avoid the pain of the first 2 years. In fact, it wasn't a shortcut at all.
Really?
It was just as difficult the second time around as the first time around. Although you've learned some things the first time around, there are new things.
And the food world's very dynamic, so it's changing all the time, and the landscape's changing all the time anyway.
Yes, exactly, so, exactly. Mm. So,
So, I would like to carry on talking, but I can't. We've run out of time again.
We need to extend the show, Sue. We'll make it a 90-minute
show
instead of 60.
So rubbish at this. So we've got 1 minute left or whatever. So if anybody's interested in the Coconut Collaborative, it's all over the place already, because obviously James is really good at business. He knows exactly what he's doing. So thank you very much to James Arvedik. And you can have a look at Coconut Collaborative by going on coconutco.co.uk. And that should tell you all about all the different products and all that sort of stuff. Definitely, definitely go for the lemony one.
And the chocolate one was excellent.
Mm-mm-mm. And thank you very much to Jerome Jacoba. I loved the wine very much. And again, if you go on to eminent-life.com, you can find out all about those lovely limited edition bottles, whatever. And of course, we also had Ali Campbell of UB40 on the programme.
What a legend.
What a mix of people. What a mix of people.
That's what we love about this show.
Yeah, also I've had pudding, I've had a glass of red wine. I mean, and it's supposed to be a job. It's not really, is it?
Are we not working?
Don't you feel envious, James? What are you doing making puddings? You should be doing this. It's much easier. Anyway, thank you very much for joining me, everybody. And we look forward to speaking to you again next week. And if you want to find anything out about the Food Talk programme, you just need to go on to foodtalk.co.uk and get all our podcasts and find out all about the Food Talk Awards that we had the other week as well.
Fantastic.
So we'll see you all next week. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.